Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero-interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is strange times we be living in, folks. So we have this fancy newfangled way of recording shows that involves no one being in the studio. So if the sound quality doesn't seem quite what you might hope it would be, that is the reason why. So bear with us. We're doing our best. I want to give a big shout out to my HRN team, Matt, the engineer and studio manager, and our excellent executive team, Katie Mosman, Kat Johnson, and everybody is doing an incredible job trying to keep the network going. So if you can find it in your heart to drop a few bucks in our beating heart at the upper right-hand side of our website, I know we'd all be grateful for that. These are, as I say, extraordinary times. And we're doing our best to keep you guys informed about what's happening with your food chain. So Derek Wagner, who is joining me today by phone, he is a restaurateur in Providence, Rhode Island. He is the owner and chef of Nick's on Broadway, which celebrated, I think, 19 years just this past spring or winter. And the newly opened Nick's on Westminster, which joined the restaurant world, I think, in July. Right, Derek?
Yes.
And Derek is also the co-chair with Marco Nishima of the Chefs Collaborative. And we're going to talk a little bit about what Chefs Collaborative is doing with its members. But first of all, Derek, thanks so much for taking the time out of your day. And tell us a little bit of the nuts and bolts about how you are managing. Are you doing takeout at Nick's on Broadway and at Westminster? Or have you had to close one of your shops? Or how are things going for you?
Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for having me on. It's always a comfort and pleasure to talk to you. Obviously, I wish it was under different circumstances today. And but again, you know, these types of things, when they happen, they're unpredictable, and it at least provides us with the opportunity to find support and comfort in each other and in our incredible food and hospitality community and arts community that we have. So thanks for having me. And yeah, it's, as you said, it's strange and uncertain and scary times that we're living in right now. And, it's strange for everybody, nationwide, internationally. Sure. And it's a hard time to be a small business owner and to be a hospitality worker, for sure. We are doing as best as I think that we can. And I am, you know, trying to approach each day with as much hope and positivity as I can muster. And I know that I have a lot of people counting on me and depending on me. So of course that, provides motivation and pressure, to try to find a way through this. And, between, you know, the over 55 employees or so that we have, as well as being the father of two little ladies and husband of my lovely wife, you know, it's a lot, and we are trying to figure it out. And it's a changing, moving landscape every day.
Yes.
And this, it just can't be understated how much of an impact this is having and how unique this situation is to have the double threat of both a health pandemic and an economic crisis happening simultaneously and feeding each other in the worst possible way. You know, one thing causing challenges for the other, and back and forth it goes. Putting strains on the healthcare system, putting so many strains on the unemployment and jobs, which of course is going to just have such far-reaching and massive effects that we're going to be feeling probably, you know, not to be too doom and gloom, but I mean, probably forever. I think at least for our lifetime. I don't know how it can't be with a massive economic impact and of course the health impact that it's having.
Mm-hmm. Well, what have you had to do yourself? Like, have you had to lay off employees?
Oh, yes. I mean, yes. And it's you know, it's just been the most. I mean, this is hard work, and everybody knows that restaurant life and hospitality life is not for the faint of heart. It's a passion project every day, no matter what you're doing, serving, making cocktails, cooking, washing, everything in between, managing. You gotta love it. You gotta love the work and the people, because there's so many other ways to just make a living that makes so much more sense. So it's hard work anyway. And, you know, with this, with the coming of this, you know, there was, it didn't just happen, you know, over the last couple of weeks. And that's, I think, something that everybody needs to understand from an economic perspective. This has been coming from the very first, you know, calls of alarm that were happening overseas in China and then in Italy. Mm-hmm. You know, it started to affect people's behavior, and people were going out less. And we probably had 2 or 3 weeks building up to the final announcements and shutdowns, where, you know, the media, you know, trying to get the information out, and some in a more earnest and authentic way, and some in a more sensationalized way, were affecting consumer behavior. And we saw a drop in business first by 50%, then down to, you know, 30%, and then the shutdown happened. So now when you look at a restaurant model, which is maybe if you're doing it right and everything is working, you're looking at still a small independent restaurant, 92 cents to maybe 98 cents of every dollar coming in is spoken for and spent. And now you diminish your revenue. We don't even use the P word for profit. It's depressing. Yeah. It's like, you know, just trying to generate cash to have operating income. And now building up with such tight margins, 2-3 weeks of that to immediately having to shut down and then make that decision and there was a lot of social pressure at that time, because as we were trying to understand it, like, was the responsible thing to do to close fully and lay off everybody, or was the responsible decision to try to stay open and provide some employment and provide food for the community? Because, you know, we live in cities where hardly anybody cooks for themselves, especially not 2 to 3 meals a day. So what happens when you just shutter every single restaurant in a city filled with restaurants where people live in apartments and don't have the means or the space or the preparation to be feeding themselves and their loved ones? So what is the responsible decision? And as a business owner and a chef and an employer, you know, that was not, it was so unclear and caused so much anxiety and stress among our community. And I really feared that it was going to get very polarizing and judgy and judgmental, what was the right and responsible decision to do. And, you know, I thought about our reality and I thought about what we were doing and our financial situation. And I just thought that we had all this food, you know, we were stocked up. We were, you know, we at Westminster, we were open 7 days a week. So we didn't really have that, you know, 1 to 2 day, that Sunday, Monday to think and adjust. You know, it was like staff is showing up, food is there. What do we do? So we decided to stay open and do takeaway and takeout and try to figure that out. And, you know, the first week of it was disastrous in terms of from an operational standpoint. I mean, we were able to help, you know, start to process some of the food, pickles and freeze and you know, make soups and things like of that nature. But in terms of sales and revenue, you know, it was a couple hundred dollars every day. And it just didn't make a lot of sense as we were doing it in both locations, because I didn't know what to do. You know, there was no time to stop and think. And, you know, it was just so much, and it's still so much, because it's, you know, it's not like it's in the rearview mirror. So it's like everything's changing every day, and you're just trying to adapt and trying to adjust. And from an, you know, the economic point of view, you know, we were already in at Westminster in our, you know, within our first 8 months of opening, and a massive build out, massive overhead, you know, 30 plus employees. You know, I had to make the decision that the hard decision to, with no clear resolution in sight. You know, there's talk of hope, there's talk of these bills and how they will help. And I'm hopeful for that. But at the end of the day, you know, we had rent, we have a mortgage or a loan. We have the payroll. We have vendors. We have people that need payment, and we have payables and taxes. So many taxes due, and we had to lay everybody off, including myself. You know, and I don't draw a big salary either. So I have servers and managers that and hourly employees that sometimes make more money than I do, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I wish better for my family and for myself, but like in terms of just trying to keep the train on the tracks, I've made peace with that in terms of trying to get to where I hope to for us to be and for us to get. And I was able for the first week to keep a staff of six or so on at one restaurant and three or four at the other restaurant. And and then after the first week, I had to close Westminster down and try to figure out if we were even going to be able to open again at Broadway. And it just, I can't even express the emotional trauma of having to lay off, you know, that many
people. I know people. You have a lot of staff that has been with you for a long time, too.
Oh, yeah, 10, 12.
So that must 14, have been especially 14, painful.
15 years. I have staff that's been with me for 15 years, you know, yeah. And no, nobody makes a lot of money, you know, but we, you know, everybody is so close and working yeah. so hard, and to just have it swept out from under you like that in such an instant, and to know that, you know, the pressure is that you're doing the right thing for society, but you're hurting the people that you love and hurting yourself. Yeah. And I mean, I'll be honest, like restaurant work often feels like that anyway. But you know, right. This is something altogether different and uncertain and scarier.
Sure.
And now, you know, we're in a position where we've had to, you know, make the decision that it's just economically unsustainable for us to reopen Westminster, and we won't
ever?
See ever. And
oh man,
and we won't even see a first birthday there. And so much time and energy and planning.
And it's such a beautiful restaurant too. I mean, for people who are not familiar, I'm going to just jump in for a second and talk about
go
you.
For it.
Derek Wagner has been running Nick's on Broadway. I think I said it was 19 years, right? Wasn't it this past?
It's 18. We're going into our 19th year here.
And one of the things that characterizes Derek's work, both in Nick's on Broadway and Nick's on Westminster, and this is in a city, Providence is a city full of restaurants. People should understand food culture in Rhode Island is paramount. It is one of the most important aspects of culture in this state. From the growing businesses of agriculture that are reviving here in Rhode Island to, you know, especially in Derek's case, his support of agricultural businesses reviving and thriving, as well as fishermen who have also been able to make connections with like-minded restaurants like Derek, who do literally do walk the walk. They buy from farmers, they buy from fishermen right off the boat, right off the farm. They do all their own slaughtering, or not slaughtering, but all their own butchering in-house. I mean, it's literally a farm-to-table establishment. So while we're talking about sort of, you know, the impacts on you, and having to literally say goodbye to this, you know, second branch of Nick's that you opened up this past July, like, what is also the knock-on effect for your purveyors? You were talking about, you know, your accounts receivable. I mean, you've got, or whatever, accounts payable. You've got, you know, all of these guys that are, some of them probably in contract to you in terms of like, yes, I'm going to grow you X number of pounds of, you know, snap peas or Swiss chard or whatever. Like, how is that being negotiated? And, you know, what are the realities in of those relationships now? What's going on with that community?
It's, I mean, they're hurting too, you know, and that's just overnight. And this is why, you know, as small and grassroots as we are, why I love being in the collaborative. And Mark, my counterpart, is, you know, is a vertical farmer.
Right.
You know, and just overnight, you know, they just lost half their business. Because of
unbelievable,
you know, and it's that way with all of our farmers, and you know, we here in Rhode Island and in Providence have such a strong chef and hospitality worker and farmer and producer connection and community, and we're so supportive of each other. You know, but these are all small businesses, and these are all people trying to feed their families. And I know that what I'm dealing with is massively traumatic to my life and to the lives of the people that I'm charged with, you know, taking care of and being responsible of. But so is it for them, and they're going to be feeling that they're already the second wave that's going to be affecting these layoffs, these loss of incomes. I mean, there's no way around it. If you are selling goods, if you are in the market to sell anything to consumers, and if your consumers are restaurants or hospitality businesses, you are all but dried up at this point. And now, when it comes to perishables, you've got just the potential loss of so much product and food that is just mind-bending. And that's lost revenue. That's food that could be feeding people. And again, it just, we've already been doing so much to show the schism in food waste versus food insecurity and the paradox of that. And now you take something like this and it just amplifies that. And there are, of course, so many places that they could donate some of their food, but now you're forced with lockdowns and shutdowns and logistical challenges where how do they get that? How do they harvest this stuff if they don't have a workforce? How do they get it to the food bank? How do they how do they process this stuff? You know, there's so many layers to this that as this comes out, I think people don't fully understand that yet, and it's just going to keep resonating in the worst way possible, amplifying in the worst way possible. So our farmers are hurting, and our small producers are hurting, and we're trying to, you know, with this little bit of takeout, I picked back up with takeout at Broadway just because I don't know what else to do, you know, and I have to try to keep going and try to provide, you know, we're trying to do some good work with the food that we're doing and try to keep at least a trickle of cash flow so that we can try to get some money to our farmers and our vendors. And, because it's not lost on me that, you know, if we make it through somehow, will the farmers or the small wine shops and other businesses and producers and fishermen, will they be there when we're done?
That's right. At the other end. That's what I've been thinking.
And all this work that we've done to make these connections, to create these, you know, from an economics standpoint, counterintuitive, you know, pushback on factory farming and these massive supply chains that have caused and wreaked so much havoc in our world today. You know, we've done so much across the country and the world to move the dial in that direction. And now that's all on the verge of a very, very fragile state right now. And it's scary, and it's really scary. And, you know, we think of restaurants are always the canary in the coal mine when it comes to consumer behavior, because the first thing that people do is they're like, oh, I don't know if I have that extra $10 to go to the coffee shop. I don't know if I have that extra $15 to grab that sandwich or that extra $25-$30 to go grab dinner here. Right. Let's try to do something cheaper, or let's maybe eat twice today instead of three times today, or, you know, cook at home once and then maybe grab something small, you know. So we see it first and then it trickles out, but it's trickling out already. And, you know, the statistics are just mind bending. And so far, and we're only a few weeks into this.
Yes, true.
And it's just massive.
It is hard to sift through all the layers of fallout, which you've just eloquently described in terms of the food chain. We're going to take a short break here for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Derek Wagner, owner of Nick's on Broadway and once upon a time, Nick's on Westminster. Stay tuned.
The James Beard Foundation is a nonprofit with the mission to celebrate, nurture, and honor chefs and other leaders making America's food culture more delicious, diverse, and sustainable for everyone. And right now, it's working to respond to the dire situation the food and beverage community is in due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Restaurants, bars, and other independent food and beverage operations are often on the front lines of community revival. The majority of culinary community businesses have less than 500 employees, but collectively, this industry generates $1 trillion a year, 60 of which is pumped back into their local business communities. To help bring swift economic relief to these essential businesses, the James Beard Foundation launched a fund to provide microgrants to independent food and beverage businesses in need. You can donate today at jamesbeard.org/relief.
This is Katie Kiefer speaking. I'm talking with Derek Wagner, a chef and restaurateur here in Providence, Rhode Island, talking about the impact of coronavirus on the restaurant industry in general, on his own establishments in particular. He shares a philosophy towards food that is going to have a very significant knock on. And by the way, Derek, you know, if you don't mind my saying, you're not the only one in Providence who sources the way you do. I'm thinking of, Ellen from Ellie's and Gracie's. Yeah. What is her last name? Ellen S.
Flattery.
Flattery. Yeah. Also a fantastic restaurateur. Mm-hmm. Also an early, you know, like you, an early supporter of buying directly from producers. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine that she's going through really the same, if not worse in a way, because Gracie's is a high-end restaurant, big ticket, menu. So that must have really taken a hit in the early days of the virus, like when people started to ratchet their
behavior. Absolutely. I mean, everybody, Ellen has several locations as well, and, big team, and she and so many others in the community, Jake at Tallulah's and Matt at Chez Pascal and Bo at New Rivers and James at North and Big
and
King
Oberlin,
Ben at Oberlin and Birch, and we're all feeling it, and we're texting each other and trying to keep each other up to date and be there for each other, you know, as best as we can through this. And, there's a bunch of us that, that are so close, and I feel like I have a pretty good reputation in terms of having an open door policy where, you know, any chefs and operators and business owners shoot me texts or messages and ask questions
you're a leader because you're the co-chair of Chefs Collaborative. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to my next question, which is what kind of role is Chefs Collaborative able to play in terms of a crisis like this? I mean, you have a national membership. Mm-hmm. It's a very big organization.
The outreach is huge, and the community is massive, it's a hard time. I was just talking to Mark earlier today, just a few hours ago, and messaging Sammy Mansour out in LA, and I'll be trying to follow up with some of the other chefs later today, and trying to keep up with each other and message each other on Instagram as we're balancing so many hats. And the best thing about the collaborative is that it's all owner operators and smaller business managers for the most part, and people that are really on the ground in the trenches. But that's also really challenging too, because we're the ones, that are trying to figure out how to survive this. Bandwidth is at an all-time low and tension. But at the same time, there couldn't be, a more important time for community and connectivity and shared resource and support than now. So I feel like our role is amplified and in partnership with and hopefully, aggregating and driving people to resources and connections that can help with specific challenges and commiserate in a way that is encouraging and hopefully hopeful and, you know, sharing the burden with each other. I feel like that is the most important. And in terms of just our networks alone, you know, and between the collaborative and the Beard Foundation and the way that we've just built, you know, through text and email and instant messaging and direct messages with social media, which so many of us use for our, you know, to try to connect with our with each other and with our guests and customers. You know, we're rallying the troops and trying to generate not just this support but this unified voice that we must be heard. And this is now, you know, this has been coming in terms from the economic piece, I feel, for a long time. You know, the economic model, traditional model of a restaurant, it has been on the brink of extinction for years now. The move to fast casual, the move to how do we do more with less? How do we operate in this new economy? And again, you know, any business that spends 92 to 98 cents on the dollar, it does. Why would you do it? Why would you do it? Right? And so this is really from the economic piece, of course, is like the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of exposing the fragility of our industry. You know, and we have people that now are still, you know, that are commenting as we ask for help and saying, well, you know, if you were good at what you did, you'd have money set aside for that, you know, and like things like that. And it's really heart-wrenching and challenging. And, you know, and at the end of the day, you're like, you know, you're right, but I guess I'm not. And I guess we're not, I guess, I don't know what to tell you, but, you can't have, you know, you can't pay the same price that you paid 25 years ago for the same meal. It doesn't make sense. And it's time that people have a reckoning with that and understand that, you know, the argument of, well, I could go to the grocery store and pay and buy that for so much less, you know, like people still say that. And even though they have 10 people serving them or they walk into an establishment that's insured and has air conditioning and has, you know, Wi-Fi and all these things, and like, you know, we have to understand that this is bigger than what's happening right now. And, if we don't act, if we don't unify, if we don't share our story, if we don't call our congressmen and our representatives, if we don't speak out, then there will be nothing left on the other side of this. There will be nowhere. It'll be corporate and takeout, maybe, you know, but your beautiful cafes where you have your comfortable nooks and quirky coffee cups and your favorite pubs that are owner operated where the owner is pulling pints or your small restaurants where the husband and wife or the chef owner or chef manager or owner operator is there to greet you and has a staff that remembers your name and is kind and knows exactly what you like and when you like it, you know, that's all going to go away. And I think we need to be prepared for that. The public needs to be prepared for that. If our elected officials and our government and also are the people that have been profiting off of us, the insurance agencies and insurance industry, doesn't act, you know, and doesn't act accordingly, then this is life as we know it is changing and will not go back, and it will not go back. And the longer this goes on, and it's not ending anytime soon, it's just not, you know, National Guards are mobilizing all over the country.
They came to my house. And you know where I live, Derek. I live way up this, you know, long ass dirt road. And I'm out there shoveling manure with my cousin the other day. And this, you know, this huge cop cruiser and a van full of National Guardsmen pull up. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather. And they're like looking for New Yorkers. Well, I'm a former New Yorker. I mean, I didn't know whether they knew that I had been in Europe for 2 months and they were tracking me down for that, or whether they thought somebody told them I was from New York and that I don't know. But it was really a trippy experience, I'll tell you. I appreciated it on the one hand, but it was a chilling moment.
Yeah,
no question.
It's sobering, and it all feels like a bad episode of Black Mirror, you know. And I just want to wake up.
Right. Listen, before we go, because we're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes, or people will, you know, with their flea-like attention spans, will stop listening. But I do want to ask you one question, which is this. When you speak about a unified voice presenting to Congress, whether it's on a state or a federal level, what is the, you know, like, what are you hoping to get in terms of, airlines are getting billions of dollars, you know, all these other big tech industries will undoubtedly get billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. How much, you know, ballpark, maybe this is an unfair question to ask, but ballpark, what do you think would be an appropriate measure financially to help prop up restaurateurs like yourselves with the, you know, sort of with the supply chain that goes along with them? How can you convey that necessity to the powers?
I think that's, it's hard to articulate it in terms of just direct, you know, money and cash, but what's needed right now is time and money, you know, and by that I mean, if we're not going to give reprieves on from lending institutions, from creditors, from credit cards, from mortgages, from insurance payments, if we are not going to give those reprieves, then it has to come in the form of cash, right? And if it's not going to come wholly in the form of cash, which we know it won't, then there has to be immediate stoppages on, or grace periods in terms of health insurance, in terms of liability insurance, in terms of workers' compensation insurances, in terms of taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, in terms of loans and loan forgiveness expansion. All of those things are so important. We have over 7 million jobs have been lost in just the last few weeks across America in the hospitality industry. 7 million. Right?
Yeah.
$1 trillion generated by the culinary industry. And that's 4% of the GDP yearly.
Okay, well, thank you for those statistics.
Dollars, right? So we have 11 million Americans employed in independent restaurants, is what I'm being told, and that's an estimated $225 billion lost revenue over the next 3 months. Right? Now, that is going to have massive and far-reaching impact. And what we're hoping, and what I'm hoping, and is that there is an actual acceptance, understanding, and immediate action taken to help curtail the fallout from this. And this happens, you know, I've been this week alone, I was on the phone with a group of small business owners with our Congressman Jack Reed, and also Representative Jim Langevin, and separate calls, you know, trying to understand these bills that are coming out, how they affect us, what our responsibilities are as employers, right? Because you know, there's so many ramifications. What are the resources? What's the time frame on this? You know, with these systems, unemployment insurance are being the systems are crashing. I have staff, you know, showing up asking to use the computer because they're, you know, they can't do it from home, and they're trying to figure out how to use the site, and we're trying to help them. And, you know, it's just massive. And we need space, we need breathing room, and we need money, and we need assistance. So I think what we're asking is that one, people understand the massiveness of this, and two, that you call your congressmen and your representatives, and you try to convey the importance that not only the workers, but the workers and the small business owners need help and need immediate action, because tax credits is what some of the first bills are offering, you know, are not going to help us if we are shuttered and we can't reopen. You know, tax credits at the end of the year don't help. You know, an SBA loan, you know, with a 3.75% interest, the last thing that a small business needs is another loan, another mortgage to pay, and that's not going to help it. So we need more, we need better, we need them to act, and it needs to be meaningful, but most importantly, it needs to be expedient, because the bills aren't stopping. The bills are not stopping. And if we lose coverage, if we lose insurance, if our properties go into foreclosure, then we cannot provide for any of the people that depend on us. And we employ so many people, so many good people, and we're all trying to do the right thing. So we're coming together as best as we can, while of course spinning the plates of taking care of our own and figuring out how we're going to get by the day to day. And we're just asking that everybody lend their voice to that effort.
Well, thank you, Derek. We'll wrap it up on that. And to be continued, let's speak again in a few weeks.
Thank you, Katie,
and just
so much.
Kind of keep a finger on the pulse of what's going. I know HRN is doing a lot with other chefs and other groups, but you know, I've got my own little constituency listening. So thank you so much for your time. I wish you all the best, my dear fellow. You're such a wonderful guy, such a great member of the community on so many levels. It just breaks my heart to hear this story. So I hope that, you know, a resolution is found that everybody can live with in the very, very near future, like tomorrow. So thank you so much for listening, folks. Thanks to my engineer for hooking me up with this fancy rig here. We managed. I hope the sound isn't terrible, but stay tuned. We'll have more about the restaurant industry, and then also about farming and agricultural production and what this all means in terms of our food chain. So thanks everybody for listening, and thanks to my sponsor. Over and out for now. See you next week. Bye-bye. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.